These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by The Teaching Company. The Great Courses cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the teaching company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. These lectures are titled Introduction to Judaism, Part 1. Your lecturer is Dr. Shai Cherry of Vanderbilt University. Professor Cherry is the Mellon Assistant Professor of Jewish Thought at Vanderbilt University. He holds degrees in philosophy, politics, and economics from Claremont McKenna College and received his Ph.D. in Jewish Thought from Brandeis University. As Dr. Cherry pursued his doctorate, he served as a family educator at a Reform temple in the Boston area and taught rabbinics and modern Jewish thought for Hebrew College. Professor Cherry's research focuses on biblical interpretation and the nexus between science and Judaism. Three 20th-century Jewish responses to evolutionary theory appeared in the 2003 volume of Aleph, Historical Studies in Science and Judaism. Professor Cherry has received numerous awards for his work in community education and continues to teach across the United States and in Israel. Professor Cherry prepared the course guide that comes with these lectures. The course guide includes a detailed outline of each lecture, a glossary, a timeline, biographical notes, and bibliography. To get the most out of this course, you may find it useful to follow along with the outlines or review them before or after each lecture. Lecture 1, Torah, Old Testament, and Hebrew Bible.
Hi, my name is Shai Cherry, and I'm presenting the Introduction to Judaism course for The Teaching Company. An introduction to Judaism is not as easy as it sounds, because Judaism itself is more than just a religion. Judaism incorporates an ethnicity, a culture, a lifestyle. Some people talk about Judaism as a civilization. What we're going to be doing in this course is looking at the specific religious aspects of Judaism as they have changed and unfolded over a 3,000-year period from the Hebrew Bible or Torah to today. But we can't totally ignore the historical changes that serve as the backdrop for some of these political, theological, and religious changes that also track on to the way that Judaism has unfolded through time. The Hebrew Bible is Judaism's foundation text, but knowing the Hebrew Bible will tell you surprisingly little about how Judaism is expressed in the modern period. So we'll begin our course by taking a look at the relationship between the Hebrew Bible, the Torah, the Old Testament, and contemporary Judaism, what the relationship is between those terms and modern Judaism. We'll then begin to describe the early varieties of Judaism, and by early, I mean about the time of Jesus, about 2,000 years ago. Although Jewish history is not one long tale of travails, there have been several catastrophes that powerfully shaped the Jewish consciousness. So in the second lecture, we'll talk about the history as presented in the Hebrew Bible, from the destruction of the first temple in 586 to the destruction of the second temple by the Romans in the year 70 of the Common Era. That 586 was before the Common Era, and we'll talk about why we're not using BC and AD also at that point. In the wake of the destruction of the Second Temple by the Romans, there were several groups that had been competing for power, for hegemony, within that Jewish community, and the winner was Rabbinic Judaism. So in general, for the rest of this class, for the rest of the course, when I talk about Judaism, I'm really talking about Rabbinic Judaism, unless I specify otherwise. So after discussing what we know about those power struggles to assume leadership in the Jewish world, we'll look at some of the core values and practices of Rabbinic Judaism, specifically Torah study, repentance, worship, and deeds of loving kindness. We're going to keep our eyes on how those ideas and values are expressed in the Hebrew Bible, but also to get a feel for the innovative daringness of the rabbis, to see how the rabbis developed those ideas in a world that no longer had the central religious institution that characterized biblical Judaism, namely the temple. Not everything changes once the temple is destroyed, but many, many things change as a result of the destruction of the temple. And so we want to be sensitive to how the changes in the political fortunes of Israel affect changes in religious practice as well as theology. With the destruction of the Second Temple in Jerusalem in the year 70, holy space in terms of the temple becomes less important, and holy time or holiness in time becomes more important. It's promoted. So we're going to spend several lectures looking at specific holidays in Judaism that shape the Jewish calendar and that really give punctuation to the Jewish year and to Jewish life. So we'll be looking at the Sabbath and the high holidays, the New Year and the Day of Atonement, Passover and Pentecost, as well as some minor holidays. And we'll be sensitive to the fact that many of these holidays in the Bible were rooted in the land of Israel and agricultural holidays in the land of Israel. But once the Jews were no longer living in the land of Israel, other aspects of those holidays had to be accentuated. At that point, we'll move into the Middle Ages and take a look at some of the new expressions of Judaism that we see in the Middle Ages, specifically Jewish philosophy and Jewish mysticism, starting in the 11th and 12th centuries. We'll take as our case studies the problem of evil, the creation of the world, prayer, and the reasons for the commandments, and see how Jewish philosophy and Jewish mysticism have very different responses to what the underlying conditions are for creation or evil or prayer. Our next five sessions will be devoted to Judaism as it makes the transition into modernity. And so we'll be looking at the emergence of the Jewish community from its insulated medieval corporations, as they were called, how they lived and governed themselves, to emancipation. And in emancipation, everything changed. Right? You can't find an expression of Judaism today that's just like Jews lived 300 years ago. Emancipation changed everything. So we'll be taking a look at ultra-Orthodoxy and modern Orthodoxy and Reform and Conservative and Reconstruction as Judaisms as a way of understanding how some of those groups 200 years ago, 100 years ago, adopted themselves to the new conditions in Western Europe and then later on in Eastern Europe of emancipation. And really, for the first time in 2,000 years, we have the opportunity of people identifying themselves with either the land of Israel, namely this phenomenon of Zionism that hadn't been possible for 2,000 years, or people identifying themselves with the people of Israel, people who are cultural Jews and may very well be atheists. Right? You can be a Jewish atheist, although it's a contradiction in terms to be a Christian atheist. The reason why you can be a Jewish atheist is precisely because Judaism incorporates more than just religion. So you can identify today with the land of Israel, the people of Israel, or the Torah of Israel, and really relate to Judaism primarily as a religion. Our last few sessions will take a look at how some sensitive and controversial topics have unfolded from the biblical period to today. Specifically, we'll be looking at the role and status of women in the Jewish world. We'll also be looking at how Judaism understands Christianity. Is it an expression of idolatry because of the divinization of Jesus, or is it another path to the one God? And finally, we'll talk about the vexing question of Jews as the chosen people. Were we chosen? If so, by whom? And for what purpose? In general, this course could just as easily be called an introduction to Judaisms, because we'll see that for every topic we cover, we have a multiplicity of responses and a multiplicity of answers. So on the one hand, the course could be an introduction to Judaisms. On the other hand, we want to be sensitive to what is common and what unites all of the different Judaisms that we discuss. Okay, so let's now move into our first topic, which is the relationship between the Torah, the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, and Judaism over here. Now, the terminology affects how you understand what we're talking about, how one designates that corpus of books, variously known as the Old Testament, or the Hebrew Bible, or the Tanakh, often involves ideological assumptions about how the text is to be understood. The word Tanakh is the Hebrew acronym for Torah, which in this sense means the five books or the Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, Tanakh. That N stands for Nevi'im, which is the Hebrew word for prophets, and Ketuvim, Ka, Tanakh, the Ch and the Ka in Hebrew have the same letter, is the writings. So the books in the prophetic section, we have the historical books of the prophets, like Joshua and Judges and Samuel and Kings. And then we have the big prophets like Ezekiel and Jeremiah and Isaiah, as well as the minor prophets. And the Ketuvim, the writings, we have Song of Songs and Proverbs and Psalms and Ruth and Esther and Daniel up until Chronicles. Right? That's the Tanakh. The Old Testament is how some early Christians referred to this text, since it had been superseded in their eyes by the New Testament. Jews generally don't refer to this book as the Old Testament because they don't have a New Testament. So Jews often call the entire book Torah. The word Torah literally means a teaching or an instruction. In Hebrew, the way we say teacher is more or mora. And in the wisdom of the Hebrew language, the way to say parents is horayim, which has the same root as Torah, because according to biblical Judaism anyway, it's your parents who should be the primary teachers in the family, right? Not shipping them off to the public or private schools. So maybe the folks that do homeschooling know this truth about the language. But the word Torah can mean just an individual teaching. It can refer to the entire five books. Torah can also refer to the entire Tanakh. And Torah can also refer to what happens later and including the whole warehouse of Jewish thought and expression, including what we do in this room today. Some contemporary scholars, in an effort to maintain religious neutrality, they opt to describe this text by its language, the Hebrew Bible. Now, it's true that some of the later books, like Daniel, also have Aramaic. So the entire book doesn't have Hebrew in it, but the vast majority of words in the Hebrew Bible are indeed in Hebrew, even though we've got some Aramaic as well. But the problem with describing it as the Hebrew Bible is that faith communities have a very different reading of the Hebrew Bible, whether we're talking about the Christian faith community or the Jewish faith community, than do academic scholars of the Hebrew Bible. I tell my students at Vanderbilt, where I teach, that I don't know very much about the Hebrew Bible. Why? Because I didn't get my PhD in Bible, where I would have had to learn Akkadian and Ugaritic and Mesopotamian myths in order to compare the Hebrew Bible to the other contemporary languages and literatures that were going on at the time the authors of the Hebrew Bible composed those texts. If they want to know something about the Torah, about Jewish interpretations of the Hebrew Bible, you know, I'm happy to try to help. I know something about that. But there's a disjunction between what the academics will tell us about the meaning of the Hebrew Bible and how Jews and Christians relate to that text. Furthermore, the assumptions about the authorship of the text often vary dramatically between the academic community and Jews and Christians. So we're going to talk about some of the differences, not just in terminology, but the differences in meanings and the assumptions about the text with case studies from the creation stories of Genesis 1 through 3 and that law that appears three different times in the Hebrew Bible or in the Torah, as I will now refer to it, about not seething a kid, lamb or a baby goat in this case, in its mother's milk. Okay, so let's talk about the assumptions of the text before we actually get to these case studies. up until about the 17th century, both Christians and Jews related to the Torah as a divine document, whether it's divine dictation or whether it's channeling from God to Moses. But the traditional assumption was that God presented what is in the Torah to Moses at Mount Sinai. Additional assumptions about the Hebrew Bible, traditional assumptions, include that the text was cryptic. It meant more than it said on the surface. So you need to read deeply in order to understand what God had intended in that text. After all, if the Torah was written by God, then it should be read differently than if the Torah was written by human beings. If it's a instruction manual by human beings, you want to follow the text literally, because human beings don't know how to write in a kind of encrypted way for an audience. But both early Christian and early Jewish interpreters of the Torah understood that the Torah was cryptic. It was also perfect. Now, what does that mean, that the text was perfect? It was not filled with contradictions. It was not filled with misspellings or with abnormalities between the gender of the noun and the gender of the verb, which you have to have consonants in Hebrew between the gender of the noun and the gender of the verb, and that it would be good, right? It's perfect. It's good. Right? Modern scholars don't share that assumption, but we'll talk about modern assumptions in a moment. And finally, that the text of the Torah or the Hebrew Bible is relevant. It's not just an old, dusty history book filled with genealogies, with people's names who you can't pronounce, but it says something to you and is meaningful to your life today, and it will be that case for every subsequent generation, right? Because why would God waste God's breath, as it were, on writing history when we're more concerned about the present reality than about what happened in hoary antiquity? Beginning in the 17th century, a few Europeans, most notably Baruch Spinoza, who was eventually excommunicated by the Jewish synagogue in Holland in the Netherlands, they begin to take tentative steps towards understanding the Torah as they might any other text. So they don't want to project any of their assumptions about the text or assumptions in terms of what this text must mean onto the text, but they want to read the text to see what it says for itself and not assume anything about the text. By the mid-19th century, biblical criticism was established in Germany and slowly and painfully made its way to England and the United States. The assumption of biblical criticism is that the Torah was written by men. It's got to be men, although one author suggests that there may have been a woman involved in one particular strand of the Hebrew Bible. But generally, the scholarly assumption is that a group of men wrote the texts that make up the Hebrew Bible over a period of hundreds of years. And these men didn't always agree. And if you know anything about synagogue politics or about church politics, the idea that men don't always agree shouldn't come as a great shock. And you see these differences of opinion reflected in the text themselves. So the idea that the traditional assumption that the Torah was divine, no. Maybe there was a divine element to it, but it was human authorship. The traditional assumption that the Torah was perfect and there weren't any contradictions, no. Biblical criticism thrives on the contradictions between different authors or different schools that the scholars tell us made up the edited text or the redacted text of the Tanakh, of the Hebrew Bible. And the idea that the traditional idea that the Bible was cryptic also goes by the wayside in terms of modern assumptions about the text. The text means what it says. No more, no less. Okay, so much for our assumptions of modern biblical critics. Now let's take a look at two episodes in the Torah and see how different the Old Testament, Tanakh, Hebrew Bible can be, especially from contemporary Judaism and also contemporary Christianity. So let's start by looking at the creation stories in Genesis 1 to 3. The first thing to note is that I said the creation stories in Genesis 1 to 3. there are two different stories of how God created the heavens and the earth and everything that is in it. The seam between these two stories is Genesis chapter 2, verse 4. And many Bibles actually will show you by splitting the verse in half that the first half of Genesis 2:4 is the coda or the conclusion to the first creation story. And the second half of the verse of Genesis 2:4 is the prologue to the second creation story. Now, these stories are totally different. They have different names of God. In the first creation story, Elohim, which is usually translated as God, is the actor. In the second creation story, Adonai Elohim is the actor. Adonai is the tetragrammaton, that four-letter name of God that was usually pronounced only once a year by the high priest in the Holy of Holies on the Day of Atonement on Yom Kippur. It is usually spoken as the Lord. It is usually spoken as Adonai. We don't pronounce that name. And then the translation is usually Lord. So the Lord God is the actor in the second creation story. The first creation story happens in 7 days. There we go. 7 days. The second creation story happens in 1 day. The first creation story in Genesis 1 has human beings created very last. The second creation story has Adam, the human being, created first. The first creation story actually has everything created as an entire species, including human beings, So that when God creates Adam, the Hebrew word is Adam, God creates humanity, male and female, he created humanity, right, in the divine image. It's only when Genesis 1 gets put before Genesis 2 that we get this idea that God created one human being, and how that one human being could be both male and female perplexed some of the early commentators who suggested that the first human being might have been a hermaphrodite. Because in the second creation story, we have only one human being created, Adam, a man, and then later on a woman is created from his rib or in some understandings from his side. So the meaning of these stories changes radically depending on how the editor places them together. Another thing that's interesting about the creation stories is that, they're relatively insignificant in the Hebrew Bible, especially the Garden of Eden story. The Garden of Eden story gets a couple of mentions in the prophets, not even mentions, but allusions to. The first creation story becomes, right, prominent in the Decalogue because we're supposed to keep the Sabbath or keep Shabbat and rest on the seventh day according to the Decalogue as it is iterated in Exodus. It's reiterated in Deuteronomy. Why are we supposed to keep the Sabbath on the seventh day? Because God created the heavens and the earth in 6 days, and on the seventh day, God rested. Of course, Shabbat becomes much, much, much more important to Rabbinic Judaism than it does to the Bible. So, right, the creation stories are there at the beginning, right? It's a good way to begin a story. Right, especially if you understand, or if the editors understand, that this God that we're talking about is the universal God of all humanity, so you start off with creation. But the importance of the creation stories is much more important to Pauline Christianity and Rabbinic Judaism than it was to the redactor or the authors of those stories in the Torah themselves. So although Judaism and Christianity read the creation narratives differently, their readings are deeply influential for both faith communities. For example, you've got 6 mentions. This is the refrain. There was evening, there was morning day one, there was evening, there was morning day two. Rabbinic Judaism understands that because it says there was evening, there was morning day one, that the day begins in the evening. Now, this causes much confusion when you're looking at a calendar that has the Jewish holidays, because it'll tell you when the first day of the holiday is, but you start celebrating that holiday on the previous evening, because that's how the rabbis understood the Hebrew Bible. Well, that's probably not what the Hebrew Bible meant, and indeed there was a Jewish scholar in the 13th century in France whose rabbinic name is Rashbam, Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir. The rabbis are very interested in acronyms. So everybody, if you've made it in the Jewish world, you know you've made it because you have your own acronym. So Rosh Baum is Rabbi Shmuel Ben Meir. Turns out to be Rashi's grandson, and we'll talk much more about Rashi in the future. He said, no, right? The text in Genesis 1 tells you what God did during the day. God punches the time clock at 5 a.m. Then it's evening. Right? God doesn't work in the evening. He keeps regular hours. And at the dawn, when there's morning, that's the conclusion of day one. And now we're going to start to tell you what happened in day two. So a day is a kind of commonsensical day when the sun rises. He says that. That's what biblical scholars agree with. But nevertheless, in Judaism, in rabbinic Judaism, you light candles on Friday night to start the Sabbath, not on Saturday morning. Did Rosh Baum want to light candles on Saturday morning? No. Absolutely not. But he said, look, let's be honest about what the Hebrew Bible means, and then let's do what the rabbis tell us to do. In Christianity, Pauline Christianity from St. Paul understands that the human disobedience in the Garden of Eden by eating from the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, which God had specifically commanded Adam, not so explicitly Eve, but specifically commanded Adam not to eat from, that stained all future generations of human beings. That's the idea of original sin. Well, you don't get that idea from the Hebrew Bible itself. Indeed, in Genesis 4, you've got the story of Cain and Abel, where God specifically says to Cain, right, you've got this tendency to do evil, this psychological tendency, but you can master it. Human beings are not depraved and committed to a life of sinning and transgressing. You can overcome that through your own free will. But Pauline Christianity emphasized this idea of original sin as a way to explain what Jesus came to atone for. So Judaism doesn't understand that there is original sin, neither do contemporary scholars from the Hebrew Bible itself, that original sin is something that was an interpretation of the Hebrew Bible by early Christian communities, just like the day starting in the evening was an interpretation of the Hebrew Bible or of the Torah by early rabbinic communities. So what scholars say about this text is often very much at odds with what the faith communities of Judaism and Christianity have to say about this text. Okay, the next element in the Hebrew Bible we're going to take a look at is the prohibition of seething a kid in its mother's milk. One of my colleagues at Vanderbilt, Professor Jack Sasson, recently wrote an article saying, yeah, we got it wrong. One of the interesting things about Hebrew in the Torah is that it doesn't have any vowels, it doesn't have any punctuation, it doesn't have any capital letters. So you really have to have an interpretive stance toward the Torah to know where one word begins and one word ends and if it should be read as a declarative or an interrogative. In this case, Lo tevashel gidi b'chalav imo, which is the prohibition against seething a kid in its mother's milk, Professor Sasson suggests was misread, that it really should say not chalav in its mother's milk, but chelev, right? Same letters, but different punctuation, different vowels. So you shouldn't see the kid in its mother's fat. Oh, you shouldn't see the kid in its mother's fat. What does that mean? That you shouldn't kill two generations in one day, because the only way you can see the kid in its mother's fat is if you kill the mother to get the fat. And indeed, there's another verse in the Hebrew Bible that says you shouldn't kill two generations of a species of animal in one day. So it makes perfect sense. And then Professor Sasson goes on to cite other ancient Near Eastern parallels to this idea. But that's not how the rabbis read it. The rabbis read that prohibition as you shouldn't see the kid in its mother's milk. Now, I would argue, or at least suggest, argue might be a little too strong, that the reason why the rabbis read the verse that way is because of their assumption that the Bible was perfect. Being perfect, the Bible doesn't repeat itself. God assumes that people are going to be listening closely and reading closely. And so you don't need to have two verses that say, don't kill two generations of species on the same day. So you've got one verse that says, don't kill two generations of species on the same day. You've got another verse that you read as milk instead of fat, right? And it gives you a different law. The problem with this law is that it's repeated three times. But what about the assumption of perfection, that God doesn't repeat himself? So the rabbis here assume that each time the verse is repeated, it's coming to teach us something new. That's the language of yeshiva, right, or Jewish seminary, right? And sometimes they use their thumbs in order to illustrate. So the first time the Bible tells us, do not see the kid in its mother's milk, it means do not cook milk and meat together, right? It's a specific example of that general prohibition of cooking milk and meat together. The second time, wait, I'm on this thumb. The second time the Bible says, do not see the kid in its mother's milk, it means that you shouldn't eat milk and meat together, even if it's cold. Even if it's cold, right? That's something new. Does it say that in the Hebrew Bible? Is that the plain contextual meaning of the Hebrew Bible? Is that what modern scholars say the Hebrew Bible means? No. But with this rabbinic assumption of the perfection and the fact that the Torah is cryptic, right, meaning that you have to read deeply into it, that's how the rabbis understood the repetition. Now I'm back on this thumb. And the third instance of do not see the kid and its mother's milk means that you're forbidden from financially benefiting from the combination of milk and meat. Right? In other words, well, this is a question now. Can a Jew that's committed to traditional Jewish law work at McDonald's, where you're selling Big Macs and not Whoppers with cheese, but right, cheeseburgers? So when I was in yeshiva in Jerusalem, seminary, my teacher asked us that question, and we said, you know, we just learned this law. No, because if you can't benefit, you're getting paid from serving milk and meat together. But it was a trick question, because the meat that McDonald's serves is not kosher meat, and these laws only apply to kosher meat. So you can't serve kosher meat and milk together, and you can't benefit from them being served together. Okay, fair enough. So we see here that these three rabbinic rereadings, or two rabbinic rereadings, of the second and third repetitions of that verse vary greatly from what the Hebrew Bible, or scholars of the Hebrew Bible, will tell you those verses mean in context. That's an example of how Judaism often interprets the Hebrew Bible in ways that are very much in tension or at odds or in disjunction with the plain sense of the Hebrew Bible. And what we're going to be looking at for the rest of this course is how Judaism creatively rereads or creatively misreads, as some people might say, that Hebrew Bible in order to keep Judaism current with the needs of the community. So we'll start next time by taking a look at Israelite history as presented in the Tanakh. Thank you.